This podcast contains elements that may be alarming to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You are now listening to British Bears, the True Crime Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to British Murders, the podcast focusing exclusively on listener-suggested British murder cases. I'm your host Stuart Blues and this is the second episode of Season 13. Before we get into the story, let's break the ice. The show's first opening icebreaker segment is this.
True facts that sound like bullshit.
Did you know that blue whales are so ginormous that a human could swim through their arteries? The major blood vessel of a blue whale's heart is so big that a baby could crawl through it. They are the largest creature ever to have lived on Earth. Now it's time for the show's final opening icebreaker segment.
Random quote of the day.
Think not is my 11th commandment, and sleep when you can is my 12th. That was said by Herman Melville's Captain Ahab in Moby Dick. This case was requested by Louise Jordan on Facebook and Amy Ritchie on Instagram. We're back in the town of Kilmarnock this week, or Killy as it's known locally, which is located in the county of East Ayrshire in southwestern Scotland. We were there as recently as episode 9 of season 11 when I told the story of the murder of Catherine Kelly, so please go back and listen to that episode if you want to hear some facts about the area featured in this week's story. I've got one little disclaimer of sorts that I want to mention before we begin. This story is so named after the person murdered by this week's perpetrator, but those of you who know the full story may question that, because another person died at the hands of our perp. Why, then, have I not named this episode after both people? The answer for me is simple. It's because our perp had his murder conviction overturned on appeal and was cleared of all charges. Rightly or wrongly, that decision ultimately falls at my doorstep, and I like to follow the official verdicts whenever I can to keep the show as objective as possible, as my long-time listeners well know. I will, however, be telling the story of that second person, as well as that of Barry Wallace, the person named in this episode's title, so I'm covering all bases regardless. With that, let me start by telling you a bit about Barry and his family. There's not too much to tell, if I'm being honest, which indicates he had a decent, if not rather ordinary, upbringing. Typically, when researching cases, you'll find that only the negative things get recorded, as is the way with most news, so I'm taking it, based on the lack of background information available, that Barry was raised well. He had a loving mum and dad, named Christine and Ian respectively, who worked hard to provide for him and his older brother Colin, whilst offering them as much love and guidance as any parent could hope to give their kids. Just 3 years separated the two siblings, which, as I've said before on the show, is a common age gap with children. Ian earned money working for British Telecom, BT, as a telephone engineer, and set a fantastic hard-working example for both his boys so they'd follow in his footsteps and excel in whichever career path they chose. A student at Grange Academy, Barry was a model pupil who worked hard to achieve his grades and, according to his teachers, had an incredibly bright future ahead of him. Known for his impeccable attendance, enthusiastic demeanour and pleasant personality, he was adored by students and teachers alike. Opting to focus his studies on the one area especially close to his heart, physical education, one can only wonder what he'd have gone on to achieve had his life not been so cruelly cut short. The popular lad was a dab hand at snooker and didn't mind the occasional 18 holes on a golf course, not only enjoying the physical and mental aspects of both, but also thriving in the camaraderie and banter that only competitive sport can bring. Just 18 years of age during this story's tragic events, Barry secured his first working role within an industry so many young adults turn to when starting out, a supermarket. I did the exact same thing at Barry's age, although where I opted to send my CV to Morrison's, he ended up working for Tesco. The store's higher-ups recall how he'd always make sure to speak with the customers as he stacked the shelves, offering a level of customer service unrivalled by his colleagues. It wasn't just those lucky customers who got to engage with him, though. One trait of Barry's that made me smile whilst researching his background was his innate ability to give up his own time and offer a shoulder and a listening ear to anyone who needed it. Given his size, 6'2", he had understandably been described as quite literally a tower of strength for his mates. The amount of tough times that led to smiles once in Barry's company are countless. Just seeing that persistent beaming smile on his face was enough to lift the most upset person out of the dark place they were in, and Barry's positive outlook on life was infectious beyond belief. Like all 18-year-olds, he loved music and going out with his friends. There's no feeling like being legally allowed to go out, let me tell you, so one can only imagine the fun times everyone had with Barry at his local, the Howard Park Hotel. Located directly next to Tesco, I'm assuming the one Barry worked at, it's located a tenth of a mile away from his family home on Cumbria Drive. The hotel, which was sold to the supermarket giant after its original owners went into administration, was one of Kilmarnock's finest venues back in the 70s. But it fell into rapid decline soon after, with its closure in November 2010 being followed by its demolition 3 years later. Here's an example of how giving and selfless Barry was. He once won 250 quid, roughly 450 today, on a puggy machine. That's a Scots term for a fruit machine, also known as a slot machine or bandit, amongst other slang terms. My point is that the money Barry won disappeared within a couple of days, but not because he treated himself to a bunch of lavish material items. That wasn't Barry's style. He opted instead to spend the money on other people, which speaks volumes as to his character and morals. With that, we arrive on Saturday, December 4th, 1999. As anyone who's worked in retail knows, weekends are prime working days, given most other people have them off, and it's often the only time they can get the shopping done. On that weekend, Barry had booked both the Saturday and Sunday off because it was a staff's work party on the 4th, and rather than battle through the next day at work with an hangover, Barry did the sensible thing and planned ahead. He wanted to let his hair down and have a good time with the colleagues he'd grown so fond of as they had him. Given his age, it may very well have been the first ever work Christmas party he'd had the chance to attend, so why not enjoy himself properly? Held at the Fox Bar Hotel on London Road, now known as the Douglas, the night out appears to have had no incidents worth discussing. It went as planned by all accounts, with Barry having a wonderful time getting to better know his fellow workers. At some point during the evening, Barry had spoken to his dad, Ian, who asked if he was planning on coming straight home when the party finished. Barry advised he had a few other options lined up, as he didn't want the night to end so soon, the most likely of which being another party being thrown by one of his mates. That story is backed up by a friend of Barry's mum's who was at the same work party that evening. She recalled him telling her he was off to a party in the nearby village of Hurlford, some mile and a half away from the hotel. "I'll see you tomorrow, Dad," were reportedly the last words Barry said to his father. As the evening turned into the following morning, Barry was clocked by one of his mates at around 1:45 a.m. at a taxi rank, although he doesn't appear to have got a ride. Barry opted to continue his journey to the next party on foot. Having said that, the next sighting of him was at 2 a.m. by a CCTV camera located close to the Foregate in the centre of Kilmarnock, which, if I'm not mistaken, is a retail area of the city. Someone from Killy will probably correct me on that. On the CCTV footage, Barry can apparently be seen stumbling over quite badly next to an all-night garage or convenience store to the extent that his forehead was cut. The precise nature of what happened after that last sighting is known only to the person who murdered him. But before I introduce that person, let me explain what happened in the days after the party. With Barry not returning home on the Sunday, his parents became increasingly worried. Their ultra-responsible son would no doubt have called them to let them know where he was had he stayed over at a friend's house, but they hadn't heard from him since he called Ian on the night of the party. As Sunday night came and went with no further update on their youngest son's whereabouts, Ian and Christine decided to phone the police and report him as missing. With officers now on the lookout for the 18-year-old, everyone who knew Barry was hopeful that he'd return home soon and had perhaps had nothing more than a heavy night from which he would soon return. Just one day after being reported missing, a team of police divers taking part in a training exercise at Roar Denon, apologies if I'm saying that wrong, made a shocking discovery. Located on the east shore of the mammoth Loch Lomond, the third largest lake in the UK by surface area, volume, length and max depth, Roadennan was where the Central Scotland Police Underwater Unit did their test dives. The dismembered left arm and left leg of a human were found that day by the divers, who quickly brought them to the surface and informed their superiors. By the end of that week, a dismembered right arm and right leg were recovered, bringing the total number of limbs found in the loch to 4. Each limb was wrapped in black polythene bags, most likely refuse sacks, and had been dumped in shallow areas of the loch close to the shore, indicating someone had thrown them into it from what can only be described as a small pier. With a murder inquiry now officially launched, over 40 officers were tasked with finding the remaining body parts, the head and the torso. A helicopter was also brought in to help aid the search, whilst a profile was attempted to be made based on the body parts recovered so far. The first description was that of an 18 to 40 year old male standing between 6 foot 2 and 6 foot 4 with dark hair, something I assume they gathered based on the hair present on the arms and legs. It's worth reminding you here that Barry Wallace was 18 and stood at 6 foot 2, but his family were assured that the likelihood of the body parts belonging to him were extremely slim. The figure I kept seeing was 99%, meaning the detectives told Barry's family that the body parts were all but guaranteed not to be his, which led to his parents being quoted in the newspapers saying, "We're distraught, but we do not believe the body in the Loch Lomond is Barry." Detective Superintendent Douglas Nielsen led the search for the remaining body parts and said this at the time. "Searches and other checks are continuing, and I can confirm that, over the weekend, in excess of 100 members of the public who were walking or sightseeing in the area were spoken to." With nearby areas of the loch searched with no other discoveries made, the belief was that the missing head and torso may have been buried somewhere close by, although searches of those surrounding areas led to nothing. Police forces throughout the UK were looking through their respective missing person list to try and figure out who the limbs belonged to, but within a week, Barry's family, along with several others, were asked to provide DNA samples. They were assured once more that the body was not Barry's, but by providing a DNA sample, it would confirm that suspicion. They became more confident that the limbs were not Barry's when the police changed their description of the victim. He was now thought to be aged between 20 and 25, all but ruling Barry out, even though he was just 2 years younger than 20, but the victim was still believed to match his height. The new estimate was that he stood between 6 feet and 6 foot 2. Detectives also had no idea what the cause of death was, never mind a potential motive. They couldn't even say where the suspected murder took place. Barry's family provided samples of their DNA on December 14th, just 2 days before another grim discovery was made, this time on Barassi Beach in the seaside town of Troon. Located some 41 miles south of Roadennan, Barassi Beach is popular with local dog walkers, and it was one such person who found a severed human head on the morning of December 16th. The first thought on everyone's minds was that it belonged to the same person as the limbs found in Loch Lomond, but police at first refused to make the link official. They wanted to wait until a post-mortem had been completed before doing so, with forensic expert Dr. Jose Tavadia, who was working the case, saying, "There are not many possibilities, and there are high suspicions about it being the same person. I am almost certain, but have still to complete the tests." Gossip was strife in the local area, with many throwing in their 2 pence as to what had happened to the poor man. Some believed it was gang-related, an assassination used to send a message, with others thinking it was to do with drugs. As I alluded to at the start, Barry Wallace didn't have a bad bone in his body. He didn't have a criminal record and was not involved in any form of criminal activity that I could find. For it to be gang or drug related just didn't make sense if the body parts belonged to Barry, which only further fueled the fire regarding his parents' belief that he was still alive. Local Dr. James Mann was called in after the head was found, even though he was retired, and offered the following opinion. "From my experience, he had not been dead long. If that had been the case, there would be some decomposition, but there was not. It was not bloated, and the fact it was found so far above the high tide mark doesn't point to it having been washed up. The head was of a dark-haired man aged in his 20s or 30s. The comment regarding the high tide mark all but confirmed the head was dumped by someone, just as the limbs in the loch had been, and there's no way it wouldn't have been spotted sooner had it been there a while, given the amount of foot traffic the beach experiences. The most logical explanation was that someone had dumped the head overnight, and given the spot where it was found was so open, had it been placed with the sole intention of being found so quickly? Was the killer toying with the police by doing such a thing? Sickeningly, given the lack of decomposition, the head was in near perfect condition, the possibility that the killer had kept the head in either a fridge or a freezer could not be ruled out. Who was to say whether more body parts weren't being kept in similar conditions to be revealed at a later date? That were just one of many disturbing yet plausible options the police had to consider at the time. On the evening of December 16th, Barry's parents' worst fears were realised. Despite being told consistently that the limbs were not Barry's, the DNA results said the complete opposite. Each of the four limbs were positively matched, with the head reportedly being identified by a family friend. Ian and Christine's beloved young son was not coming home. He had been killed and dismembered by an unknown third party. The next morning marked 12 days since Barry was last seen alive, and it was that Friday that detectives chose to raid a flat at Doon Place in the Belfield area of Kilmarnock. A search warrant had been acquired, but the officers who took part in the raid were shocked to discover that the person they were interested in speaking to was not home. That person was 36-year-old William Beggs.
The story will continue after these quick messages. And now, back to the story.
William Frederick Ian Beggs was born in Northern Ireland in the mid-60s, either 1963 or 64 is my logical estimate, with his upbringing taking place in either the village of Moira in County Down or the town of Lurgan in County Armagh, depending on which source you choose to believe. They're just over 4 miles apart, separated by the A3, and it was in one of those areas where his four siblings and he were initially raised by their parents before being moved to the town of Portadown, also in County Armagh. Beggs grew up with his dad as the Ulster Unionist Party mayor of some town nearby, that's what Beggs claimed anyway. He was therefore raised by his working class parents as an Ulster Protestant. I won't go too much into the religious division of Ireland and its history, but essentially, back when Ireland was one country, Ulster, located in the north, was one of its four provinces. Six of its nine counties would then become known as Northern Ireland in 1921, with the other three remaining with what became known as the Republic of Ireland. At school, Beggs excelled. He was a very smart boy who went on to achieve impressive grades, 9 O-levels and 2 A-levels, whilst attending Lisburn Grammar School. Hobby-wise, Beggs was interested in politics most of all, which makes sense given his upbringing, whilst also being a keen debater and music lover. After leaving school, Beggs wouldn't be given much chance to pursue his career aspirations in his own country because he seems to have been forced out by a loyalist group called the Ulster Volunteer Force. The reason was due to Beggs supposedly having been acting inappropriately towards some boys in the area, which led to rumours doing the rounds that he was a paedophile. When confronted by the furious group, who used guns as a means of extra persuasion, Beggs soon scarpered across the Irish Sea to England. In the early 80s, he began an undergraduate degree at Teesside Polytechnic, now called Teesside University, which is located in the North Yorkshire town of Middlesbrough in northeast England. His subject of choice was public administration. At uni, the perception of Beggs was that he was a quiet lad who kept to himself, but when he needed to, he could ferociously come out of his shell. Beggs's political nous and knack for debating led to him quickly becoming the chairman of the local Federation of Conservative Students, something no doubt aided by his notoriously right-wing views. One example of such views was Beggs's participation in a campaign called Save Ulster from Sodomy, an anti-gay operation launched by the late Ian Paisley. But regardless of what side of the political spectrum you fall on, perhaps the most important thing to note about Beggs was that he portrayed himself as being a run-of-the-mill student who enjoyed the challenge of acquiring a degree. There were no overt signs that he had a bad bone in his body, and none of his peers had any cause for concern when it came to him. They clearly weren't privy to the rumours that led to him fleeing his native land, but Beggs no doubt came up with a whole new backstory should anyone ask about his early life. Resigning from the student union in 1983 due to what he perceived to be its anti-British views, Beggs was in hot water once more 3 years later when he was arrested for fly posting. He was putting up Ulster Says No posters without the permission of property owners. So technically he was arrested for that offence, but the political side of what he was doing likely played a part too. I'll leave it for you to research the Ulster Says No campaign should you wish to. We now arrive at Tuesday, May 12, 1987, and it was on that day the body of a 28-year-old man called Barry Oldham was found at a beauty spot called Clay Bank in the North York Moors. Beggs, who lived at Prince's Road in Middlesbrough at the time, had met Oldham at Rockshot's nightclub in Newcastle just a few hours after the latter arrived in the North East looking for work. Originally from Bolton but working in Aberdeen in North East Scotland, Oldham, who I'm referring to by his surname simply to avoid confusion as he shares the same name as Barry Wallace, had also spent some time in the USA with a religious group called The Way, according to one source. Wanting to sample the infamous Newcastle nightlife, Oldham, who was an openly gay man, attended Rockshots, or Rockers as it was known to the locals, because it was the place to be at that time for those in the LGBT plus community. You might wonder then what Beggs was doing there, given his political views and the campaigns he supported. The reason appears to have been to find someone to physically attack, because based on his previous offences, Beggs targeted gay men. I'll come on to those previous offences shortly. After chatting for a while at the club, Beggs offered Oldham a place to stay at his home. Once there, Beggs slashed his guest's neck from behind with a razor before attempting and failing to dismember him. He was arrested in June 1987 and claimed to have killed Oldham in self-defence after being propositioned and fondled on a camping trip the pair had agreed to go on the day after they met. He'd go on to claim he panicked and tried to dismember Oldham's body after inadvertently killing him. During his murder trial at Teesside Crown Court in December 1987, some other charges came to light which revealed a hidden sadistic side to Beggs's personality. Not only was he accused of murder, but he also faced charges of wounding regarding five separate attacks on four men between 1985 and 1987. In total, he was suspected of being involved in 14 incidents between early 1983 and June 1987. A series of bizarre instances, including the age of some of the victims, their unwillingness to attend court, and a complete lack of evidence, led to Beggs only being convicted of two wounding charges. They related to incidents that occurred in November 1985 and January 1987, both of which involved flatmates of Beggs. He plied each of them with alcohol before indecently assaulting them and slashing at them with a sharp instrument. Regarding Oldham, some of his blood was found inside Beggs's flat, which ultimately led to him being unanimously found guilty of murder by the jury of six men and six women who took 5 hours to deliberate. Beggs's successful appeal of that murder charge came to a head in June 1989 when he was released from London's Pentonville prison. Lord Justice Russell, sitting with Mr. Justice Farquharson and Mr. Justice Brooke, agreed that the judge who tried the murder case should not have allowed the jury to hear evidence of the alleged earlier attacks. They could not consider a substitute conviction of manslaughter because his legal team had raised the issue of self-defence, and although one of his convictions for wounding was upheld, he'd already served his time for that. Once more forced to move out of the area he called home, Beggs moved up north to Scotland, settling in Kilmarnock and becoming a council housing officer. A further conviction came in 1991 when Beggs was found guilty of repeatedly slashing a man called Brian McQuillan with a razor, causing major injuries to his leg. Brian was forced to leap out of Beggs's first floor window naked to escape the onslaught. Receiving a 6-year sentence, Beggs was out in 3 and quickly began studying for another degree, this time at the University of Paisley, which is now known as the University of the West of Scotland. Disliked by his neighbours, Beggs supposedly set up a series of CCTV cameras which looked out onto the street. His argument was that he did so for protection and home safety, whereas the locals rumoured he were getting his kicks out of searching for young boys. Their attempts at getting him evicted would end up backfiring when Beggs were given permission to buy the property, which he duly did. That brings us to the raid on that very same flat on Friday, December 17th, 1999. Beggs had attended a work party at a hotel with his colleagues the night before, a cruel irony not lost on me, I can assure you, and he took up the offer of staying over in one of the rooms there. He had no idea his flat was about to be raided, so upon wakening, he went down for breakfast in the on-site restaurant before heading to work at Sykes Call Centre. It was only after hearing about the raid of his home on the radio during his shift that he realised he needed to make himself scarce. Shaving off his distinctive beard, Beggs headed back to Northern Ireland, and despite breaking his door down with a battering ram, the police refused to name him as a suspect. DS John Geat said, "We do not have a particular suspect in mind. There have been no arrests and we have interviewed no one in connection with that flat. A search was carried out there and at the lockup as part of a number of inquiries. We are actively seeking no one at the moment." The lockup he's referring to was owned by Beggs and located around 100 yards from his flat. He was last seen walking past it in the evening before the raid, carrying what witnesses described as a large holdall. It didn't help that Beggs hadn't been seen at the university for a good 3 months either, so the police really didn't have much to go on. Finally, just a few days before Christmas, an arrest warrant was issued for Beggs. The police force was highly criticised by certain sections of the media for their, quote, bungling of the case thus far, but Barry's parents spoke up in their defence, reaffirming their support for the detectives' work in the case. Turning to the internet, detectives tracked Beggs down to Amsterdam within a week of the warrant being issued. He is said to have then voluntarily handed himself in at an Amsterdam police station on December 28th, although he went prepared, as he was accompanied by advocate Leanne Mannheims. It took over a year for Beggs to be extradited back to Scotland due to a series of appeals, which eventually saw the Dutch Supreme Court uphold the decision. Beggs finally arrived at Edinburgh Airport under police escort on January 9, 2001. His murder trial then commenced at the High Court in Edinburgh that September, and the trial lasted just over 3 weeks, with the jury returning to the court with a majority guilty verdict regarding Beggs's handcuffing, injuring, sexually assaulting and murdering of Barry Wallace before dismembering his body. Plenty of evidence helped the jury make up their minds, including blood found on a mattress and kitchen door in Beggs's flat, as well as on a piece of discarded carpet. The chances of the blood not belonging to Barry were said to be 1 in a billion. Sentencing judge Lord Osborne handed Beggs a life sentence with a minimum term of 20 years, something the convicted man planned to appeal. In the 23 years that have passed since his conviction, Beggs has become an absolute thorn in the sides of so many. In November 2001, he staged a hunger strike in the hopes of being moved to a separate area of Sawton Prison, a common name used to refer to HMP Edinburgh. January 2006 saw Beggs in the papers once more when he declared that he wanted to become the first ever British prisoner to enter an official same-sex civil partnership with his partner in prison. Beggs said, "I'm getting married. If anyone in the Scottish prison service tries to stop me, I'll sue." Suing became a sort of hobby of his as the years ticked by. Beggs went on to become the primary legal advisor to all manner of prisoners and completed their legal paperwork for a very generous cut of their settlement earnings. After nearly 10 years, Beggs finally had his 20-year jail term appeal refused in 2011, but because it was deemed that the Scottish courts failed to hear his appeal in a reasonable time, he was awarded £4,800, around 6.7k in today's money, in compensation due to a breach of his human rights. That was in spite of Scotland's Solicitor General Frank Mulholland claiming that most of the delays had been of Beggs's own making. In June 2013, Beggs was secretly taken off the sex offenders register due to a technicality and a bit of human error. When adding him to the register originally, the clerk had wrongly filled out a form stating he was convicted of rape/sodomy as well as murder, which wasn't correct. As a result, if he's ever released, he won't be subject to the same surveillance and police visits that sex offenders are. Several other legal wins have taken place, but to be fair, most of his attempts get rejected. In total, he's made 59 applications for legal aid, 51 of which have been turned down, but each one costs valuable time, money and resources to process. 2015 saw Beggs described by a High Court judge as being a victim because prison authorities had opened his mail, something deemed to be a breach, again, of his human rights. In April of that year, and in the same month in 2019, Beggs had boiling water thrown over him by two separate inmates, but each time his injuries were not severe and didn't require hospital treatment. The 20-year minimum sentence was completed in the latter months of 2023, meaning he can now apply for parole. He did just that in December just gone, but the Parole Board for Scotland refused his application. Also in December, a blood-stained razor was discovered in Beggs's flat, which he still owns and refuses to sell, by the way, which forensic experts tested. The DNA profile recovered did not match William Beggs, Barry Wallace, or Barry Oldham. A police spokesperson said, "The blood on the razor suggests there could be another victim." And that was the story of the murder of Barry Wallace. Thanks again, Louise and Amy, for requesting that case. I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts on it. This week's new reviews are as follows. Jess Darby left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, "I am a true crime fanatic, but I've yet to find a podcast I truly adore as I prefer British Murders. I stumbled upon your podcast a few weeks ago and I've listened to almost every episode since. This is not just, however, because you tell the stories of British murder victims. It is because you tell the stories with compassion, emotion, and with a focus on the victims. I cannot wait for the next season. British Murders gets me through long drives, planning on an evening, I'm a primary school teacher, and of course, housework. Could you please cover the case of Stephen Donaldson, murdered in Kirriemuir, Scotland? I've added that case to my list for you, Jess." Claire Sterling left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, "I adore this podcast and wish there was a new episode daily to get me through my commute. I'm quite picky about podcasts and I don't like a bunch of nonsensical banter or a dry monotone host, but this one is just right. I love that he starts each episode with a bit of background on the place it took place, really sets the scene. He's got a charming accent and a charming little girl who reads the title of each segment. Bless. I've also heard a few facts in this podcast that I hadn't heard in other pods covering the same case. Keep it up, mate." Finally, Lee Karen Hannant left a 5-star review on BritishMurders.com. It reads, "You young man have got it, bottled it, sold it, and hit the jackpot. I've been a follower of true crime long before podcasts ever existed, and this is the best way of discovering the who did what and why. I admit, as someone who, as I said, loves true crime, I heard a lot of stuff I already know, but you've got a knack of picking up the bits others miss in your no-nonsense and unapologetic way. Keep going, lad." Thank you, Jess, Claire, and Lee, Karen as well, maybe, for leaving those reviews. If anyone listening would like to leave a review of the show and have it read on a future episode, just head to iTunes, Facebook, Podchaser, or BritishMurders.com. You can also leave me a star rating on Spotify. Thank you if you do that. Please head to patreon.com/BritishMurders and sign up for an OBE or CBE tier. By doing so, you'll get early and ad-free access to all future episodes. You'll get a load of bonus episodes, regular giveaways, welcome goodies, and my British Murders weekly journal series. Hello and welcome to my newest Patreon members, Karen Millar and Sarah. If you'd prefer to support the show on a one-off basis, just head to buymeacoffee.com/BritishMurders. Thanks, Ben Hasty, for doing just that and buying me a beer on there. The message left was, "I've been listening to the podcast non-stop since I discovered it. The tone is fantastic. Stuart strikes a perfect balance between the seriousness of the crimes and the absurdity of life. Cheers from Australia." Please continue emailing case suggestions to contact@britishmurders.com or message me via social media. You will get the episode covered. I do have a lot on there, but you will get it covered eventually. And when you do, you will get a shout out, just like Louise and Amy did in this episode. And that does it for another British Murders case. I've been Stuart Blues. This has been British Murders. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, cheerio.